Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, as promised on this Monday afternoon. I told you it was going to be two really good hours. In this hour, Dr. George Delgado is with us. Dr. Delgado is an ethicist and physician, and really the person we turn to for help. As a matter of fact, I happen to know that many people turn to him for personal help here at Catholic Answers, but also for professional help in understanding ethics issues involving human life in its earliest stages, in its mid period, whenever it's in crisis, and in its late stages. Dr. George Delgado, let me see if I have this right. Medical Director of the Culture of Life Family Services. Did I get that right?
That's right.
Okay. I wasn't sure if you had changed to a different title. Dr. Delgado, I suppose the primary ethical issue everybody is concerned with these days has to do with vaccines and COVID. Is there any news on that front or anything you want to share with us in that regard?
Well, certainly there are three vaccines. There are probably 120 vaccines that are in some stage of development against the SARS-CoV-2 virus, which is the virus that causes COVID-19. And it's from a scientific standpoint, it's really been remarkable that they've, in many cases, compressed about 10 years worth of research into about a year worth of time. And so that some people are really scared by that. And I'm not scared, but I'm cautious, because you're always cautious when things are done more quickly. But it's reassuring to know that one of the things they've done is not necessarily they've cut corners, although we need to be cautious about that and on guard. But mostly what they've done is, because of the huge amount of money put into it and because of the stakes are so high and a lot of companies are willing to invest a lot, is they've carried out many of their steps that previously were serial steps, and by serial, S-E-R-I-A-L, in other words, one after the other. Instead of doing it that way, they've done them in parallel. So they've been doing basic science work and production work at the same time, running phase one trials and phase two trials at the same time, phase two trials and phase three trials at the same time. Normally things that are done sequentially now are being done simultaneously. So that has really been a big time saver. The big risk, of course, is that you do all these things simultaneously, let's say with a certain vaccine candidate, and you say, oh, let's stop because this phase one trial showed a lot of side effects, or something showed that maybe this isn't as good as we thought. Well, then you stopped right there and you've invested a lot more money than you would have if you did things sequentially. So that's one of the issues. The other is, of course, that people are concerned that something so new that they know that this kind of virus, an RNA virus, it's typically harder to make vaccines for it. We're also creating new types of vaccines that have never been used before, and specifically the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines, which are the two leading the pack. These are so-called mRNA vaccines. And what mRNA is a little strip of RNA, which is sort of the mirror image of DNA. And what happens with mRNA in normal cellular processes is that the mRNA is transcribed from the DNA, and everybody knows that DNA is in the cell nucleus, and that's the blueprint for the entire cell. Every protein that is made by the cell is coded on the DNA. Well, the DNA is transcribed to mRNA. The M stands for messenger. That mRNA then floats out to the outer part of the cell called the cytoplasm, outside of the nucleus. There are little factories called ribosomes, which attach to the mRNA and translate it into proteins. And in this case, this little mRNA snippet is injected into the body, and the body itself then makes the protein, which happens to be the protein spike of the virus. So this is a way of getting the body to work to make the vaccine for us. And this has never been done before where anybody's ever successfully made an mRNA vaccine. So this is really the frontier of scientific research. And so far, it appears that the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines are very, very effective. As far as the ethical concerns, there's been a lot of controversy in Catholic circles, I would say, for the most part, where in fact the Bishop of Fresno, the Most Reverend Joseph Brennan, just came out with a statement saying that we should not be using those vaccines because they have a remote reliance on systems that used cells from aborted babies in the past. Now, there are two concerns here that the very, very legitimate and universally held concern by faithful Catholics are the vaccines that are actually grown on cell cultures. They're actually grown on cell cultures, and those cells are human cells that were initially started from what are called immortal cell lines, and those immortal cell lines were initially started with cells taken from aborted babies 30 to 40 years ago. And really, there's no question that everyone who's a faithful Catholic considers those to be ethically tainted. And we know that we have an obligation not to use those if there's a suitable vaccine substitute. And the Vatican document from several years ago, Dignitas Personae, really spells that out. But it also says that if there's no suitable vaccine substitute and it's a serious disease, that we are allowed to use those vaccines. Well, these two new messenger RNA vaccines, they are not grown on human cell cultures because they're actually not viruses that are being produced. Rather, they've just made artificially these little snippets of mRNA, which then allows our bodies to make the proteins. So how are these possibly ethically tainted? Well, there are some testing parts when they were first developing the vaccine. They were testing to see if the proteins would work and how things would work out, where they actually used these testing systems that did rely on human cells that were from these immortal cell lines that were originally started from aborted babies. So you can see that the connection is nowhere nearly as direct or as dependent or as constant as the ones where the vaccines are actually grown on these human cell cultures. But nonetheless, some people, including Bishop Brennan, feel that that's a sufficient connection that we should reject these outright. And the National Catholic Bioethics Center and Charlotte Lozier Institute have come out with some opinion pieces and lists, and they feel that really that's not so, that this is a remote enough connection that we would not be significantly participating in evil. So there's that controversy there. The AstraZeneca vaccine that's coming out of the UK, that one definitely is ethically tainted, being grown on human cell cultures, and there are a few others that also are. There are several others that have no connection whatsoever. We'll see if they get to the front of the pack. I would say that as it is right now, that with these three vaccine candidates that all appear to be about equally effective, that the first two, the Pfizer and the Moderna ones, would be the ones to choose. And I think that in good conscience, if people feel that they're medically safe, they could choose those vaccines because of the very limited reliance and the very remote connection with those testing systems, and that those two should be chosen over the AstraZeneca one from the UK at this point in time. And so we'll see if others come out, of course, later. But right now, there really is a time pressure because of the pandemic, of course.
Yeah. Well, that's part of what I wanted to ask you as well. And it's a pro-life open forum. You can call with any questions about preborn life, life in its earliest stages after birth, or as care for those who are at the end stages of life, any pro-life, any question having to do with the whole pro-life movement, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. You don't have to agree with us. As a matter of fact, we'll try to convince you if you don't, but we're happy to take your call and explain to you the Catholic position supported by the best possible ethics and science on whatever your issue is, 888-318-7884. Are there ethical issues, I suppose, is what I wanted to ask you as well, Doctor, with the distribution. Are you at all concerned about any groups being left out or an unfairness in the distribution? Or do you think that enough kind of money and resources have been put into this distribution that it's basically going to get to everybody?
Well, it's going to get to everybody sooner or later. But there will be ethical considerations up front because, you know, the Moderna, I think, has a guaranteed 20 million doses initially to the United States. It's a two-dose vaccine, so that would mean 10 million people could be vaccinated, while Pfizer, I think, is going to have enough to vaccinate about 25 million people. So that's still a small portion of our population. So we will have to make some decisions. We have to make decisions based on limited resources, and it's in a way, it's a triage. And so when you do triage, you try to put the most resources where you can have the best effect. So who's going to get the vaccine initially? Well, it's going to be frontline medical workers, people working in emergency departments and ICUs, and as well as people who are very vulnerable, people who are in nursing homes, people who have lots of comorbidities. And then from there, it'll go out to maybe less vulnerable people and people in medical professions who don't have as much contact with sick people, and then finally to the general population. So I think most ethicists would agree that that makes sense to maximize the benefits when there are limited resources. Now, of course, the devil is often in the details, how they carry that out and to make sure that that there are certain groups that are not unjustly discriminated for whatever reason. But I think for now, at least the stated plans seem to be relatively reasonable.
Very good. Okay, thank you. Dr. George Delgado is our guest. You are welcome to call with your pro-life questions, 888-318-7884. I'll preview my question when we come back, but I do want to encourage callers, if you have questions about abortion or euthanasia, assisted suicide, or any other aspect of a bioethics question, perhaps, 888-318-7884 is the number to call. Dr. Delgado, I'm of the mind that it is appearing more and more likely that the injustice of the Roe versus Wade decision might be overturned, but that would mean fighting over abortion in the states. And so I'd like to ask you when we come back about what are appropriate goals to have as we fight for life in the states, which is the kind of second phase, one that we've worked all our lives basically to get to. And there does seem to be some hope that we'll get there. We'll do that when we come back right here on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Prayer is the only truly creative power in the world. God is the only one who can create something out of nothing. And when we pray, we welcome God into our hearts. And once He's there, He's going to do something. He's going to change things. He's going to transform us. He's going to make something out of the nothing that is me. That's the power of prayer for me. It's the only power that's guaranteed to change my life. And the only way I know to make that happen is through prayer.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. It's a pro-life open forum today. If you've got questions about life, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. Dr. Delgado, I guess the genesis of my question is this. Here we are, you and I, we both live in the state of California, which is really a tremendously anti-life case. In some ways, overturning Roe versus Wade will make absolutely no difference here, or given the political environment, might even make the situation worse. People will often ask then, can you kind of go for just kind of marginal improvements until you can have some effect on convincing people? I guess the argument goes this way. Either you got to fight for it all, you got to fight for maybe an amendment to the California Constitution that says no abortion, or you're just making a deal with the devil. But where ethically politically, what are we required to do once we actually have the opportunity to fight about these things once Roe versus Wade is overturned?
Well, I think, what's important to keep in mind is that what our obligation is to always work to end injustice, especially injustice, killing of innocent people, which is what abortion is. That's our primary responsibility. How we go about it is often involves prudential decisions, and that's where politics comes in. It's the art of the deal. And in certain states, that if Roe v. Wade gets overturned, which I think would be what we would want, in certain states, it's not going to be an issue at all, and they'll become pro-life states very quickly. You can think about states like Indiana, Alabama, probably Texas, although Texas will have a fight. And then there'll be states like New York, New Jersey, and California, where they probably will become pro-abortion states and maybe even redouble their efforts. However, even in California, where politically, I think we are seeing somewhat of a shift with some election of more conservative members of the House of Representatives, and I think people are starting to recoil at the pushing of the envelope by the pro-abortion proponents. And I think this it can still be a battle in states like this. And even if we don't foresee we're going to necessarily win the battle, I think it's worth doing things like you mentioned, which trying to amend the California Constitution so that we do protect life in California. And those kind of efforts should take place in all states, and those would be grassroots efforts in every single state, as well as in the more conservative states like Indiana, Alabama, Texas, making sure that that we still protect the right to life there, because we know that the pro-abortion forces will be sending out their own people into these states to try to change the laws there. So it's something where we can't be afraid, and we just have to push forward and make good prudential decisions. But I think we've been certainly a bit timid in the past by, for example, not supporting personhood amendments and right. things of that sort, fearing that if we try to push too far, it would backfire on us. I think we're at the point now with the Constitution of the Supreme Court, and with the current feeling across the country that people are feeling more pro-life, that I think now we really have to go for the touchdown much more than just the short gains that we've kind of been incrementally doing over the years.
Again, Dr. George Delgado is our guest. It's a pro-life open forum today. If you have questions on life in any of its stages, we're more than happy to take your call. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. We're going to start with Joe in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. Joe, go ahead. Your question for Dr. George Delgado.
Hi, doctor. I'm wondering about the use of emergency so-called contraception in Catholic hospitals. I know a number of doctors, a number of faithful Catholic doctors have written and have published that basically this stuff, you can't use this stuff without it, great, great risk of it being abortifacient. And despite what faithful Catholic doctors have said, this stuff is still being allowed in Catholic hospitals. They cite Directive 36 of the Ethical and Religious Directives to justify it. But I found interesting, you spoke a few minutes ago about dignitas personae, that there's nothing in what I can find of what's come out of the Vatican, dignitas personae, or the most recent updated charter for healthcare workers to justify this practice. I was wondering about your comments.
Well, I agree with you that I think when you really study so-called emergency contraception carefully, it's very, very difficult to defend it. And just for those who are not aware what emergency contraception is, these are in general, high-dose contraceptive doses that are taken by a woman who has intercourse and is concerned that she might get pregnant. And so they're usually given within 48 to 72 hours of an active intercourse with the stated goal of preventing pregnancy. Now, there's one called Ella, which actually can be taken up to 5 days after intercourse, and that one is surely abortifacient because it's actually, its mechanism of action is very similar to the abortion pill, mifepristone, also known as RU-46. But let's leave that one aside and just talk about the other ones. And when you critically look at how these work, or when they work, I should say, you can see that statistically, they seem to, quote, prevent more pregnancies than they really should if they were only inhibiting ovulation. And part of that comes from when they're dosed. And we know that if they're dosed at a very particular time, right before the LH surge, they actually can inhibit ovulation. But other than that, they really don't seem to inhibit ovulation. They're either given too early or too late. And when they're given too early, they cause a kind of a misfiring of the ovulation. And then when they're given too late, they can cause a disruption of the uterine lining, both of which can allow conception to occur but not allow implantation. Either the embryo doesn't get down to the lining of the uterus in time and dies, or gets there and the uterine lining is not receptive. So really, those are abortifacient effects. So the companies that make this and the people who study this, they don't want to address that, of course. And I think the Catholic hospitals that allow this probably want to remain in that same shadow of ignorance, of a plausible denial of this whole situation. In many ways, they want to be like all the other hospitals and just follow the minimum Catholic rules that they need to remain Catholic hospitals. So I think that's very unfortunate. They're not truly, many of them are not truly embracing the Catholic mission. If they were, then they would be looking into this much more carefully, and they would not be allowing this for the most part. So usually what they do, they'll require that a pregnancy test be done. If the pregnancy test is negative, then they say that it's okay to use it because the woman's not pregnant. Well, the positive pregnancy test really doesn't turn positive, the blood test, until about day 5 to 7 after about the time of implantation. So there's that window of where you could have a very early human embryonic person in existence and a negative pregnancy test, and you could see that human embryonic person would be at peril of having its life ended if these chemicals are taken. So I think that really is not sufficient. Others have said, well, we do that plus we do a progesterone level. If the progesterone level is below 2, then the risk of abortion is very, very small. And that's true, and I would say that would be good. But and for all practical purposes, those progesterone levels are not done as far as what I've read or heard. So it's an unfortunate situation. I definitely agree with you.
Okay, Joe?
And if I could just make one other comment, I'm sure that you're aware that the National Catholic Bioethics Center has basically is running interference on this, that they're basically stopped giving the bishops poor advice, and in turn, Catholic hospitals continue to use this stuff.
Well, let's get Dr. Delgado's comment on that, Joe. Go ahead, Dr. Delgado.
Yeah, so the National Catholic Bioethics Center has, it's sometimes in a tough situation where they, you're right, they're kind of the main ethical advisor to the bishops. And that's a good thing, because in the past they've had a very, very strong track record, and I did my ethical training there. However, it's also kind of a bad thing, because if this is sort of a big contract for you, or you want to be careful just from a kind of a business standpoint not to hurt anybody's feelings or to say anything too controversial. So I think they sort of need to work that out and be very courageous in stating what's really the truth and what's supported by the science, and not being afraid of hurting anybody's feelings on the bishops' conference. And part of that is they are very, very careful and cautious, and so they are probably waiting to get more scientific information on this and not making any assumptions. So I think we'll kind of have to see how that plays out.
Joe, thank you. I appreciate you raising that issue. It's a pro-life open forum. If you have questions about the proper treatment of life in any of its stages, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. We go now to Isaac in Hillsboro, Oregon, listening on Modern Day Radio. Isaac, go ahead with your question for Dr. George Delgado.
Hi, doctor. So my question is about the coronavirus vaccine. Usually safety studies take a while to do. Now, the coronavirus vaccine would be made for a disease which is affecting far less people than the average yearly flu. So my question if there are side effects that are not covered in a safety study, which is rushed in order to produce a vaccine for a population of the United States, is it okay to do this type of thing if we don't know how effective it's going to be also?
Dr. Delgado?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. I would maybe add some context to your first comment and maybe some disagreement. The coronavirus, the SARS-CoV-2, which we're discussing, is a very, very peculiar virus. And if you want to compare it to influenza, it's very, very interesting.
Dr. Delgado, I'm sorry about this. I got to ask you to finish responding to Isaac's question when we come back. The music started playing, and
okay,
we got to
sure.
take a quick break. Isaac, please hang on. This will be a very, very quick message, and then we'll get Dr. Delgado's answer to your question right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
If you spend any time on Twitter, Facebook, or mainstream media, you're probably familiar with the litany of slogans that skeptics employ to rescue you from the foolish belief that God exists. The constant onslaught seems to leave people with the idea that they have no alternative but to embrace atheism. How can a Christian respond? In One Less God Than You, John DeRosa breaks down 20 of the most common atheist challenges and shows you how to craft effective answers. Atheism is more aggressive and widespread than ever. Read One Less God Than You and prepare yourself to respond with the joyful truth that God is real. To get your copy of One Less God Than You, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
To many people, even many Christians, purgatory is a fantasy, or worse, a wicked lie invented by the church to make salvation complicated and keep people in fear. But I'm here to tell you that purgatory is fact, not fiction. The Bible supports it, Christians have historically believed in it, and it makes theological sense. In my new book, Purgatory is for Real, I provide the evidence and reasoning to help you understand this controversial doctrine and demonstrate how it's actually a joyful, hopeful reality, not something shadowy and mysterious, but a sign of God's love and mercy. To get your copy of Purgatory is for Real, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. It's a pro-life open forum. You can ask questions about life and the ethical care for human life, 888-318-7884. I do have to say, a lot of the calls I'm noticing are about the vaccine, and if they start to repeat the same question, we'll just select one and let that be representative. So I don't want anyone to have their feelings hurt that we didn't get to your question, but we don't... I mean, it's fine if that's all that happens. If everybody wants to know about the vaccine, we'll talk about the vaccine for the whole hour. But I just don't want to repeat questions. But Isaac in Hillsboro, Oregon, is on the line listening on Modern Day Radio. And Isaac, I'm going to try to sum up your point and then let the doctor respond. But it seemed like what you were saying is this is this COVID virus is not more dangerous than the flu. And why should everybody be forced to take an unproven possibly dangerous vaccine when the virus is not worse than the flu? Did I get that right, Isaac?
Yeah, that was pretty succinct.
Okay, good. All right, so doctor, if you would respond. You were starting to, and I'm sorry we had to cut you off. Go ahead.
Sure. So, yes, just a little perspective. It is a very curious virus in that it's more contagious than the flu virus. However, it hits different people differently. Well, influenza, it especially strikes the elderly and the young, the very young, the babies who are hit hardest, and those certainly with what we call comorbidities, pre-existing medical conditions. The coronavirus is similar in some ways in that it does hit the elderly more, especially those with pre-existing medical conditions. However, it seems to spare younger people, and particularly young children under the age of 10. They just don't seem to get it as much, and they don't spread it as much. So that's kind of different from the way the flu virus operates. Now, as far as your statement that it's killed less people, that's not really true. If you look at the people who've died from COVID-19, we're over 250,000 in the United States. Now, it's true that probably 90 to 95% of those people had comorbidities. But for the most part, what that means to me is that these were people who were not in the best of health. And you can imagine them sort of being on the edge of a cliff. And the last shove off that cliff was the coronavirus infection. And so, sure, you can say they died from coronavirus because they were so sick already, and if they were young and healthy, they probably wouldn't have died. That's true, but they still died earlier than they would have. And it's important, although something we call years of lost life are important. So, for example, if a young person dies from a vaccine adverse effect, that's a terrible tragedy because all the years lost. But fundamentally, the life of a young person is of the same value as the life of an older person. So we really should be careful about making those distinctions. So, a person dying is a person dying is very, very important. So first of all, that's my perspective on it. When you look at the mandate, however, I think there are some very important ethical issues there. And you make the point about maybe not proven effective. Well, that kind of remains to be seen, because I told you that they are kind of doing a lot of things in parallel, or they're doing a lot of testing in parallel. But I do have concerns about a vaccine that is put out so quickly and where the numbers of people who've had it certainly doesn't nearly compared to all the people over the years who've gotten influenza vaccine. So our experience with it will be much less. And so we're not going to truly know how safe it is at first. We'll have some degree of certainty of the safety because it has been tested in tens of thousands of people. But tens of thousands of people is not millions of people, so we're not going to know about rare side effects of the vaccines. So the question really is, should we be vaccinating people who are at low risk of coronavirus infection when we don't know for sure about the small risks or the less common risk of the vaccine? Should we instead really just focus on the people who are the most vulnerable and the people who could spread it a lot to others, like healthcare workers, or people who are going to be exposed a lot to it, like healthcare workers, or people who could potentially get very, very sick and maybe die from it, like those with comorbidities, those who have who are obese and have diabetes or have lung disease, or who are much older. So I think that's really the real ethical question is, should there be mandates or coercion for everybody getting vaccinated? I think right now, the assumption is that, well, everybody in the country is going to get vaccinated. And I think we really have to stop and question, well, is that really the best thing to do? Should we put all of these people at risk for vaccine side effects when they probably would have a very, very small chance of getting the COVID-19? And when you look at the death rate overall for everybody who's ever gotten it, including all those people who are asymptomatic, which is probably 50% of more people who get the infection, is probably between 0.1 and 0.5%. And of course, there are others who don't die but are seriously ill for a long time and maybe have chronic lung problems and other things, so you can't minimize that. But for the vast majority of those who are essentially young and healthy who get it, don't get very sick and don't have any long-term consequences. So we really have to think about that. Is the public health measure of not wanting them to spread it to others good enough, or is that overstepping our public health bounds? I think that's the real question we have to raise.
Isaac, because your question is at least in part, and certainly the general tenor of your question is shared by many people, I'm curious if you have a follow-up. I'd be happy to give you a follow-up with Dr. Delgado. Go ahead, Isaac.
Okay, my quick follow-up is, based on the effect of the shutting down society, the idea of giving people vaccines, and the number of people taking their own lives and developing alcoholism, abuse, all these other side effects as a result of the coronavirus lockdown, is it worth it
to keep society locked down because of all the bad side effects?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a great question. That's a whole other issue, actually, apart from the vaccine. Some actually might argue that if you vaccinate everybody, then you wouldn't have to have lockdowns. But I think the bigger question is, have the lockdowns been disproportionate and arbitrary and ineffective? And I think my feeling is that in many respects, the answer is yes, that these lockdowns have been disproportionate, unmeasured, and ineffective. And they have led to a great deal of consequences that I don't think were intended, but have been quite severe. First of all, the effect on the economy, and you know, we had an unemployment rate that was the highest since the Great Depression. And if you look at statistics of for young males who are generally are in the workforce, of course, and you trace the unemployment rate, you see the suicide rate for young males almost perfectly parallels the unemployment rate. So it's very, very sensitive to the unemployment rate. So we can be for sure that suicide rates have gone up. We won't know that for 2 years because of the way statistics are kept in this country. But right now, there are many authorities who are sounding the alarm that they're very concerned that calls to suicide centers are up, that suicides are probably up due to the untoward effects of our mitigation measures. The second one is the opioid misuse. And we know that opioid deaths and opioid overdoses have been going up in many areas of the country. And many public health officials have been saying that they think it's due to the whole pandemic. And of course, they're not going to say that if it's due to the virus itself or if it's due to the lockdown, but I would say it's probably due to the lockdown because for most people, the only effect the virus is having on them, except for maybe knowing a few people who've had it and recovered, and maybe a few people who've known people who've died, is really the effects it's had on their lives. And you think about someone who's susceptible to opioid misuse, what's the worst thing for that person? The worst thing for that person is to be forced to isolate, and then when they're slipping back in opioid use, is to not have the accessibility like they had before of person-to-person counseling. Instead, they have to do things online and virtually. Well, those are recipes for disaster with people who have the tendencies to abuse opioids. We've also have heard anecdotal reports of increased domestic violence, all sorts of signs of domestic breakdown. We know that many students are failing because of the online education. The children need to have in-person education, and that these school districts that are refusing to let children go back are really failing in their mission right now and doing a great disservice to our children and to our countries. We're going to have essentially a generation of children who are going to be at least a year behind in their schooling, and some of them may never recover. And this is in light of that, that children are not big spreaders of the disease, schools are not super spreading events, that there really is no reason why you can't have children go back to school using proper safety precautions. And the fact that school districts and teachers' unions are opposing this so vigorously, I think, is just a derelict of their duty to educate our children.
Isaac, I am grateful for the question and for the follow-up. It's obvious from the calls that this is on lots of people's mind. So I just want to wrap up before we go to the break with a quick question for you, Doctor, following up my own follow-up to Isaac's question. Is it possible that there would be a scenario where we could provide the vaccine to the entire vulnerable population and then just because that would likely eliminate almost all of the deaths from this, then you could just let the disease run its course and move on without having to vaccinate, you know, say 90% of the population or something?
Yes, you certainly could do that. And I would never recommend that anybody purposely get the infection because you never know if you're going to be one of those unlucky one in 10,000 who gets a very serious illness, even though you're very healthy. But I think that's not an unreasonable strategy. And that's actually, you know, what will be happening in effect is that initially we will be vaccinating the vulnerable and those who are in high-risk situations like on frontline healthcare workers. And, the virus is not going to stop while we're vaccinated. It's going to continue to move through the population. So really, that'll be happening early on and it's going to take, several months to get enough vaccine to give it to everybody who wants it or who needs it, or who won't be mandated to get it. So we'll be seeing that happening naturally.
We got to take a quick break. We'll come back with more. It's a pro-life open forum. It's not entirely a vaccine show, although it's fine that lots of people are interested in the ethics of what we're currently engaged in as a society. But any pro-life question, any question about life in any of its stages is welcome. And there is some variety to come. So hang on. We'll be right back with more questions for Dr. George Delgado.
Bringing you the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I went to Las Vegas years and years ago for one of these cable shows. And I was shocked to see all these old ladies in their 70s and 80s getting off that plane, running for a slot machine. You don't have a chance to win. They're all fixed. I know, my uncle used to have slot machines.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
St. Paul's street evangelization isn't like other evangelism you might have seen on the streets. We don't yell, and we don't force anyone to pay attention to us. Instead, St. Paul's street evangelization is committed to presenting a positive, passionately Catholic presence to a world hungry for truth. For more information or to start a chapter of your own, go to www.streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com. It's time to do our part.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live on this Thanksgiving week. I hope all your preparations are going well. Dr. George Delgado is our guest, and any pro-life question is welcome. 888-318-7884. The number. We go now to Monica in Providence, Rhode Island, listening on Catholic.com. Monica, thanks for listening on Catholic.com. Go ahead with your question for Dr. George Delgado.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about a pregnancy when the mother's life is in danger. I've heard either you or Father Ted in the past talk about how when in that situation that you would normally just try to deliver the baby, even if you had to do it there early, and try to save the life of both children, both people. But my niece is pregnant, and she's had three C-sections in the past, and they've told her that because of, I guess, the scarring and stuff that's happened, that if she, when she gives birth, she could actually, I think she could die. I think she could bleed to death is basically what they've said. So my question is, if that can't be the solution, like, is there a different alternative that should be used? And also, she is pro-life, so she's having a child, the baby anyway, knowing that she's risking her life. And others have said that she's being selfish in making that decision. So a follow-up question would be, like, how do you convince others that that is the right thing to do, like, in this culture that we live in today?
Well, you know, it's always the right thing to protect life, and it's never the right thing to take the life of an innocent human being. That's really the bottom line. No matter what the risks are, no matter what the arguments others present, you kind of have to cut through all the chaff and just know that's what you always do, the right thing. Now, as far as whether it's prudent to try to get pregnant when you're very high risk, that's different, and there you need to know the medical facts, of course. And I don't know all the facts of your niece, of course, just based on what you told me. But certainly, the more C-sections you have, the higher the risk each subsequent pregnancy becomes. And that's one of the reasons why we try to dissuade women from having routine C-sections when they really don't need them, and do their best to have vaginal births. But there are a couple of things that place a woman at risk when she's had multiple C-sections. And by the way, I've had patients in my practice who've had, you know, five C-sections, and they've done fine. But there are increased risks of potentially of bleeding and of uterine rupture, because any scar in any tissue is always weaker than the original tissue. So if you have a scar where you've had your C-sections, every time you open that scar up and do another C-section, when it heals the next time, it's weaker than it was the first time. And so it's weaker and weaker. And then when the uterus stretches out, you can imagine you stretch a scar, it might pop open. Or when it's stretched out and then the uterus starts to contract, it might tear open. and that tearing open can be catastrophic both for the baby and the mother. They could both bleed to death and die. Now, the problem is that these risks are often overstated by obstetrician gynecologists who are not pro-life, and they really do exaggerate the risks. The risks are there, but they're really, you know, like in the 10 to 15% range of rupture, something like that usually. So, you know, it's a risk that it definitely is there, but you can manage it by being in a high-risk practice, by being close to a hospital and taking certain precautions. The other bigger risk is when the placenta grows into the scar and something we call placenta accreta. That is a very dangerous situation because the placenta, as you know, has lots of blood vessels and it can bleed quite a bit. And so if you have a placenta that's into a scar, the placenta doesn't separate easily off of that scar the way it does off of the regular lining of the uterus at the time of delivery. And so when a woman has that that added complication of placenta accreta, then she's at very, very high risk. She has to be ready at delivery, essentially to have a cesarean delivery and a hysterectomy at the same time. But even being ready with that, the risks are very high of significant bleeding and even death. So these risks are real, but they have to be put in perspective. And we always need to know that you never take the life of an innocent human in order to prevent a problem from occurring. But you can deliver these babies early, and there you would be applying what's called the principle of double effect, where you would be doing one action, let's say the cesarean section and maybe hysterectomy, and knowing that you're putting the baby at risk of a preterm delivery, but you're doing it to save the life of the mother, but you're not directly killing the baby in order to save the mother. So that would be acceptable. And, of course, all of the good high-risk management, there's no ethical problem with that. And so where the prudence comes in is in the front story where, you know, the husband and the wife decide, should we take the risk of another pregnancy, knowing that we might risk the life of the mother of our other children, and we might risk the life of the preborn baby who may not survive. And so they need to get the actual facts of what the real risks are, and then prayerfully consider whether or not they should use natural family planning to avoid pregnancy.
Okay, Monica. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thanks. Just one question on the placenta issue. Is that part of the scarring? Is that just a different example you brought up?
No, he was talking about the placenta growing into the scar, so it's related to the scarring, right, Doug?
The scar, okay.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Oh, you sound
like... thank you.
God bless you, Monica. I'm sure many are praying for you. It's hard to... that's a very tough one and for your whole family to deal with. So God bless you and thank you for the call. I hope if we can ever be helpful again, you'll call again. It's a pro-life open forum talking about caring for life in all of its various stages. Let's go to Brian in Pennsylvania, listening on the EWTN mobile app. Brian, your question for Dr. George Delgado.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thank you for taking my call. So my question is about the vaccine, not specifically just the COVID vaccine, but just vaccines in general. So I understand, I'm a practicing Catholic. I understand that it's always wrong, you know, to kill a baby through abortion. But I'm trying to understand, though, like, you know, the difference between a sanctity of life issue and a sanctity, I guess you could say, of death issue, because obviously, like, we don't participate in the abortion of a aborted fetal cell line, so which they're saying can be used for lots of vaccines, especially like some of the COVID vaccines, not all of them, but some of them. So I'm trying to understand, though, like, why it would be considered immoral if you're using some, you know, an aborted fetal cell line, like, even though, like, you don't participate in the abortion, like, if it's already happened, like, why it would be considered immoral if you're using it for a good purpose. Because I think I've heard, like, on SCB Center, like, they kind of made the analogy, like, if somebody's a registered organ donor, and they are, or killed, you know, in a car accident, or if they're even murdered or something, like there was an evil to their death, but you didn't participate in that death, but like why would it be wrong that, like, for them to just donate their organs to them for somebody to benefit from it?
Okay, doctor?
Okay, yeah, that's a good question, and it does. You do touch on some issues which we consider the participation in evil, and certainly, you know, there's something called formal cooperation in evil, and that's when you agree with something that's evil, and so that's never allowed. So if you thought abortion was a good thing and then you benefited from it, that would be certainly morally incompatible with the Catholic faith. There is something called material cooperation, and that's where you don't agree with it, but you somehow participate in it, or you do something that allows it to happen. So that would be, for example, if you worked at an abortion center and you were the medical assistant, you didn't agree with abortion, but let's say you worked there because it was a good paying job. And so you were actually participating in evil and facilitating it, even though you didn't agree with it. Well, then you get more remote. And what happens here is it wasn't just a baby who died. So let's say it was a baby, it was a miscarriage, and they got the remains of the miscarriage, and they took the cells and they started these cell lines, then they would be ethically fine. But what happened with the way these cell lines were started was that the research scientist actually was at the bedside of the abortion and actually picked out that fetus because he or she knew that this was the preborn baby would give the perfect cells for what he or she was trying to do. And so it was all arranged ahead of time. And sure, the mother probably would have aborted anyway, but this connection between getting the cells and the abortion itself were intimately connected. And so there is that very, very intimate connection with the killing of an innocent person, kind of like it's not too far from an analogy to the prisoners in China where their kidneys are forcibly taken out and to be given to patients there. So you would not want to accept that kidney because it was taken forcibly from a patient who is a prisoner. And so the same way, it's not ethical to participate in the evil and to benefit from the evil of abortion, because we know that that abortion was closely tied to this research, with a researcher right there who then took those cells and created an immortal cell line, which then can beget cell cultures, and they can grow these vaccines. Because the growth of those viruses depends solely on growing in those vaccine cultures. And so that's why that connection is so strong, that we are really compelled to not use those vaccines unless there are no vaccine substitutes and if there is a strong medical reason to protect against those diseases. Does that make sense to you?
With all the, like, any type of vaccine that's used with abortion fetal cell lines, they all knew ahead of time that they were going to do that abortion for that reason, because they knew that it would be good for a vaccine. They all knew it. It's not possible for them to create a vaccine just by like any old elective abortion, and then they see the fetus sitting there and they're like, oh well, even though we, you know, that was just a different, I guess you could say, abortion.
Yes. It's never been the case where they, you know, went to the abortion clinic after the fact and say, oh, do you have any remains left over? It was never like that, and the reason why is from the scientific standpoint, they need to know exactly the age of the fetus, and the abortion also had to be done in a certain way so that those tissues were not damaged. For example, the PERC cell line is embryonic retinal tissue, so they had to be able to dissect the eyes out, so they couldn't do the abortion in a way that would destroy the eyes and just kind of chop everything up. The HEC cell culture, which is used commonly, that stands for human embryonic kidney. So they had to make sure they could identify the kidneys and get the kidneys out to get those cells. So it's just not just any run-of-the-mill abortion where everything is kind of ground up and chopped up. No, they had to be able to pull out the actual organs, see what they had, and then take those special cells. So the researcher was right there at the bedside, almost calling the shots for these abortions, you know.
That is
horrifying. Making sure they got the proper tissues.
I'm very grateful for the question and for the answer. It's very hard to listen to, but I think it's important that we do listen to those so that we know the facts of what happened. Brian, thank you for the call. Thanks for everybody who called. Dr. George Delgado is medical director at Culture of Life Family Services. Dr. Delgado, thanks very much.
It's been a pleasure being here.
Tomorrow, I think we've got 2 hours of open forum. We'll see you then, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.